Today, Are We Cooked Yet? With Professor Steve Keen. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And today it's my great pleasure to bring Steve Keen, Professor Steve Keen, back on again. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Martin. Good to be in touch again.
Yeah, indeed. And thank you very much for spending some time with us today. Mm-hmm. And look, there are so many things I want to touch on, but I think a really good place to start is the big debt question, right? Because we discussed a couple of years about there was too much debt in the system. Since then, of course, we've had quantitative easing, we've had massive amounts of increased public debt, but also private debt's rising too. So, you know, the debt we had previously is now a sort of a microcosm of a much bigger problem. So what's your read on the current state of debt at the moment?
Well, what worried me when the COVID first hit, and that was back in March of last year, what I could see was a tendency for private debt to go through the roof because people would have commitments they had to make in interest payments and so on without the cash flow. And in that situation, if you left them that way, the debt would just accumulate. And whatever happened during COVID was one thing, but if there was an after, and I'm beginning to wonder whether there ever will be an after COVID, people would come out of it with a revival of normal commerce, but a dramatic increase in their private debt levels. So something that I proposed a dozen years ago, virtually, or certainly 10 years ago, and thought there was a snowflake's chance in hell of it happening. The idea of a modern debt jubilee is something I'm now working on again, because this is slightly better. Well, to put it away, we are now the snowflake in hell. So maybe with the location change, maybe there's a possibility we'll give this policy a try to get out of hell. But yeah, and then what actually has happened, of course, is a very large increase in government debt levels, but also a substantial increase, not so much in household debt, though that's happening now, but in corporate debt. And to me, what that shows is corporations were accessing lines of credit, running up overdrafts, et cetera, because that's the only way they could meet their financial commitments. And of course, this is what's leading to a number of bankruptcies, less than I think we would have seen without the level of government support that's come in. So that's, I'm glad the government support's been there, but far more than should have been possible. The government should have absorbed all of this, because it's obvious a private sector economy cannot survive a pandemic. It has to be government finance that gets through something like this.
So in terms of the quantitative easing programs that all the central banks have created, so basically they've lifted, you know, the level of debt in the system. In other words, both sides of the balance sheets, the central banks are rising, the debt's rising, right? It's driven the cost of debt to the public sector down. And there was a very interesting report from the House of Lords that said, in the case of the UK, the quantitative easing programs were much more about driving down the cost of public sector debt than actually anything directly to support the economy. What's your perspective on that? Do you think that's true, or do you think that the quantitative easing programs were right?
Well, I mean, if that's what they think it was about, it shows how stupid our government managers are, because as I keep on realising, people don't understand the accounting involved in government debt and focus on entirely the wrong, it'd be basically irrelevant issues. I mean, it's irrelevant to reduce the cost of debt for a government that issues its own currency. What matters, when I look at what QE was done for initially, the best documents are by Bernanke, not because he knew what he was doing, but because he said what he was going to try to do. And in this instance, what he was trying to do is what QE actually achieved. And that was to take away bonds from banks, giving them reserves in place of bonds, and the central bank has a limitless capacity to do that because the central bank is the bank that the private banks bank at. The central bank can easily say, here's $1 trillion, hand us over $1 trillion of what you call assets. And so the liabilities of the bank, the central bank, rise by $1 trillion. Reserves of the assets of the bank also rise by $1 trillion. Pardon me, my cat wants to make a few comments later. is it okay having a feline interruption?
Absolutely.
I better stop him typing. He's not the world's best typer. Okay, that's enough the keyboard. Yes, so I think my cat knows about as much about quantitative easing as the central banks and the politicians do. But basically, the central banks can put an entry in the reserve accounts of private banks, and that entry every month was $80 billion per month in America in the early stages of QE, and then say in return, give us bonds that have got a face value of $80 billion. So the portfolio of the asset side, as you say, the central bank rises, the liability side rises as well, but no money is created. And this is what people don't understand. Yep. Because when you look at the level of the bank, the balance sheet of the private banks, they have two broad classes of major assets, reserves and bonds. And when the central bank says, we're going to put $1 trillion in your reserve account, so your reserves rise by $1 trillion, that's in return for handing over the bonds, which fall by $1 trillion. And the reason that so there's no change in the asset side of the private banks, which means there's no change in money, because the liabilities and short-term equity of the banking sector is fundamentally what money is. So if you don't change the assets, you don't change the liabilities or equity either, and there's no change in the money supply in Main Street, so to speak. But what it means is that the Wall Street activities of banks go through the roof, because they've lost $1 trillion of income-earning assets in bonds. They've made a trading profit out of it, otherwise they wouldn't have done it. But apart from that trading profit, they've lost the income stream. And the idea was to encourage them to go and buy shares, which they duly did. And of course, you then get effectively $1 trillion per year additional purchases of shares, which drives up share prices. And the rationale that Bernanke gave was, this will make people feel wealthier and they'll consume more. Except that the people who feel wealthier are the wealthy, and they don't consume as much by any means out of an extra dollar as the working class does. So it was actually a trivial, but it was a low level of the extra wealth created turns up as consumption. If, on the other hand, that money had gone to the working class, there would have been a dramatic increase in spending. So it gave a bit of a stimulus to the real economy, but massively drove up share prices and massively increased inequality. And that, to some extent, is the background for me saying, well, now it's time for a jubilee, which will have the opposite effect of redistributing the income and wealth towards the working class and the middle class, away from the ultra wealthy.
Well, there's two interesting points that you make there, Steve. The first is that, by definition, then, quantitative easing isn't necessarily massively inflationary, right?
No.
It could actually be almost seen as deflationary, because it doesn't necessarily hit the real economy, right? Mm. And the second point there is that the fact that all of the creation of momentum is going into the financial markets and the banks is then pivoting further value towards the very wealthy, as the 1% or the 10%, depending on where you want to look at it. So again, it's tilting the playing field away from ordinary people.
Yeah, and this is what really annoyed me about QE, because the original impact of rising levels of private debt is, again, to increase the wealth of the wealthy and to reduce the income of the poor. I modeled this in my mathematical model of Minsky's financial instability hypothesis back in the early 90s. And one of the striking results of that very simple model was that the rising level of private debt didn't mean a falling level of profit. It meant a falling wages share. So I had a model in which firms were borrowing money to build factories, which is what you'd want firms to do with borrowed money. So it was the right use of borrowed money, and then employing workers in those factories, so you get more output coming out of it, all the positive things you want. But the income distribution effect was that if in a boom, firms borrowed more during a boom than they could pay back during a slump, you had a ratcheting up of private debt. And I used a constant rate of interest. I could have a variable one as well, but with a constant rate of interest, that meant a rising share going to bankers. In a sense, the spread between deposit and lending rates has remained fairly constant. So in that sense, it's a reasonable rationale. But that meant a rising share of income going to bankers. But when I looked at the dynamics of the model, the share going to capitalists continued fluctuating around the same value as the rising level of workers meant bankers meant a falling level for workers. And so already, and that's what turned up in the stats as well, there's been the rising level of private debt in America has shown up as a declining wages share of GDP in America. Profit shares remain fairly constant. That's exactly what my model predicted. So along comes QE. We've already got a world in which bankers have been made wealthier by creating more private debt. And what does the government do but bring out a scheme which drives up the value of the shares the wealthy own and accentuates the inequality caused by the private system?
And of course, that begs then the question is that quantitative easing program, which of course is still running at $120 billion in the US, it's running here in Australia, and everybody keeps talking about tapering and things. The question is it feasible to do that, or do they essentially blow up the system if they try to do that?
That's the trouble. Yeah, I mean, way back when they began QE, I described it as a bargain with the devil. You know, you sign your life over. Well, you can't renegotiate terms after you've signed your life over to the devil. And any attempt to reverse QE will cause a crash in markets. So if you have a system which is saying we're going to be, in terms of how QE is actually implemented, we promise we're going to be $80 billion to the buy side and all the open market operations we normally do to try to control the short-term interest rate. That's what central banks normally do when they trade bonds with private banks. They're saying we're going to buy $80 billion a month. Meant that then caused a flow through to the banks, effectively using that $80 billion to buy shares. So you've got extra pressure on shares. And then the share market gets driven way, way above any sense of fundamentals, as has happened in America in particular. And then if they try to reverse it, well, the reverse operation has to happen. You've got to sell the shares. And therefore, the share market plunges. And the central bankers, their reaction, well, can't have share market prices falling. Bang, back into QE again. And so it's been QE forever. Before COVID became the news of the day, there was a crash in the stock market, which was attributed to the slow leakage of QE out of the sort of reserve created out of the system, and the rundown of those excess assets created by QE. So they were forced back into QE again. And that's what I expected to continue seeing indefinitely. The only real way out of QE, again, is to reduce private debt.
Right. And the other point there, of course, if you look at the reverse repos, which is effectively money coming back from the banks to the central bank, right, that's rising because essentially all this liquidity sloshing around the system isn't going anywhere. They're not lending it. They can't lend it. And in Australia, we have the term funding facility, which was very cheap money from the Reserve Bank to our banks, right, about $190 billion, right? But in fact, twice that is sitting back with the Reserve Bank on reverse repos here. So they've basically created so much liquidity that, you know, they're sloshing around the system, but it's not actually going anywhere useful.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's partly the tools that central banks have, which is part of the problem. Their customers are private banks and a handful of other financial institutions. And so the easy thing they can do, those are the accounts they can access immediately and do something through. Your accounts and my account, private bank accounts in general, with the private banks, which is one step removed, and the Fed can't actually put money directly in there. It's got to be the Treasury that manages that via the Fed by increasing deposits, which increases reserves, and the increase in reserves comes by deprecating the Treasury's account at the central bank. That mechanism is the only one, the only direct mechanism central banks have is to put money in the private bank's reserve accounts. And we're now seeing the weakness of that. What we really need is a treasury type operation. And so long as central banks don't have accounts for you and me at their own institutions, it's got to be the treasury that does it. And the treasury hasn't been doing it because of this obsession about running a balanced budget.
Right. So we're in the situation where we've got these central banks continuing to print. There's very little way out for them. Meantime, of course, in Australia and around the world too, house prices have gone through the roof because, of course, the other thing that can be done is to write more loans for mortgages for people to buy property, right? Mm-hmm. And we've had probably one of the biggest run-ups in property values in most Western economies as a result of COVID, right?
Yeah.
Now, do you think that is a simple reflection of government saying, well, the only thing we can do is to create the wealth effect again, which is exactly what Bernanke did back, you know, after the global financial crisis? I mean, is that what's really going on here?
I think so. It's partially that they, the only mechanism, only thing they can immediately affect are house prices, and they happily do it. So because the attitude has become that, you know, house prices are the wealth of the private sector. We can't have this plunge. So they'll do everything they can to keep house prices rising. And you're not just fighting private greed anymore with the banking sector. You're fighting the limited capacities of neoclassical economists who run treasuries and central banks. And they can't see that they're actually causing this problem.
Right. And it's interesting because, of course, the RBA says we don't have any responsibility for what house prices are doing. APRA says not our responsibility. And in fact, the only thing that happens in Australia is the federal government says, well, we can launch another inquiry onto supply side issues to do with housing. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody actually wants to tackle the fundamental driver, which is what you just said, which is basically it's debt driving the value of prices higher because of the fact of the way that they think about it. So they've got this myopic view as to what the story is. And it's like, debt's not important.
Yeah. And I mean, it just takes my breath away. They'll continue repeating that because they've got the data, and it's bleedingly obvious when you look at the data that what causes rising house prices is rising levels of new mortgages. On that note, I'll just actually, if I can do a quick share screen here, to illustrate that for Australia. This is household debt and house prices in Australia. The left-hand axis is household debt, which used to be as low back in 1970 as 25% of GDP. It sits in 120% of GDP. So, you know, virtually a five, six-fold increase in private debt levels. There's the level of house prices. And like, you know, yes, there is a correlation, as you can see, but of course they're both increasing at the same time. So you better look at the change in prices, and that's what's shown here. And the basic logic, and it's quite simple, quite straightforward, you don't buy a house with cash. Very few people do. People instead buy houses by borrowing money. So the monetary demand for houses is new mortgage debt. And if you then divide that by the number of houses on the market, effectively what you've got, or divide that into the number, that gives you an idea of how many houses, you know, average houses can be purchased. On the other side, you've got the price level of those houses. So change in the source of demand, which is far more flexible than supply in the housing market, I obviously agree with that, is new mortgage debt. That's what buys houses, and that sustains the price level. So change in new mortgage debt causes change in house prices. And even though the data is vastly different for America than Australia, when you look at the relationship of mortgage debt and house prices, the pattern is, I'll show the pattern in a moment actually, to show how different it is on the top graph I've got here for America. But the same pattern turns up down at the bottom. The change in the new mortgages correlates with and causes change in house prices. So if you want to make housing affordable, you've got to reduce the change in new mortgages. Yeah, you've got to address the debt levels. And just to quickly illustrate the America, okay, very different relationship between household debt and house prices, but the same relationship and much the same statistical strength as well at the level of change in new mortgages or change in new household debt and change in house prices. So if you want to get house prices under control, you've got to stop the rising levels of household debt. And of course, that's the last thing that the governments end up doing. They actually encourage us to continue borrowing. And one thing that really disgusted me about Australia was the Royal Commission ending up with a directive to banks to please go back to irresponsible lending.
Well, yes, in fact, of course, the Royal Commission revealed through their inquiry how badly lending was happening and the fact that many people were being cajoled to get loans that they should never have got in the first place. And then since then, of course, we've had the federal government try to remove the protection, the responsible lending protection, away from banks. We've had Wayne Byres in front of Parliament this year saying there's nothing wrong with our lending standards, at precisely the same time that he was privately writing to the banks saying tighten your lending standards. So there's this sort of public-private sort of debate going on. But the net result is, you know, the banks are just growing their profitability, they're growing their loan books, they've simplified themselves from, you know, what they were doing previously to just become big mortgage providers, I would say big building societies, and house prices continue to riot higher at a time when incomes are actually not growing, when the debt levels are becoming more concentrated because there are more affluent people who are paying down loans, and so the risks in the system become ever higher, and yet the people who are setting the rules basically can't see it.
Yeah, it's horrifying. It's a real case of how we think the world operates, screwing up how the world operates, because their visions about, the starting point is government debt is bad and private debt is not a problem. And that is completely wrong. Government debt is largely not a problem, and private debt, when it's too large, is bad, and certainly when it finances asset bubbles. So it's like watching a bunch of Copernican astronomers trying to organise a rocket launch to the moon. You think, oh God!
And just to be really clear, Steve, you know, the concept of neoliberalism, which is what underpins most of the behaviour of the way that the people in power running at the moment, it is really market orientated, debt orientated, but basically it tilts the playing field ever more towards the small proportion of very affluent people at the top of the economy.
Yeah, and this is being done by people who believe it's this, that's not what they're doing. I mean, for a start, they believe private debt doesn't matter. I had a bit of a laugh recently. You know, I had a fight with Krugman back in 2012 over the role of private debt in the economy. When we were both supposed to speak at the same conference in Berlin, unfortunately, he didn't front. But in that paper, he once said, "I'm all for including banks in issues where they matter, but why are banks important to a story about leverage and debt levels?" What? You know, I mean, and he comes from a framework where lending is from one non-bank person to another non-bank person. And if you lend money to me, you have less spending power and I've got more. And then if I repay you, you've got more and I've got less. And they cancel each other out. And that's the way that they think. That's not what banks do at all. Banks create money when they create a loan. But they record an asset for them on their side of the books, which is a debt obligation you have to them. And they put an identical amount of money into the bank account. This is the thing. It has to be identical. You wouldn't accept a $200,000 debt for a $100,000 loan, okay? And the bank wouldn't accept a debt of $100,000 if you're giving you $200,000. So they're precisely equal. And then you spend that money. So that's part of aggregate demand. And this is an addition. It is not an expense of anybody else's spending. And that's what's left out of the mainstream thinking. It's so simple to say it. It's so straightforward. But they have a mental framework that blocks them from understanding it. And then because they're the ones making the rules rather than you or me, we get these catastrophic situations, which are just, you know, they succeed for a while because there is a limitless capacity of the central bank to create money and equally also for the Treasury. And that should be directed to good ends instead of just being directed into a Ponzi scheme.
Absolutely, yes. Well, I've consistently said for a long time now that the money could be redirected into much more effective, real business, real economic outcomes, if it was invested wisely, which of course is what MMT is all about. You create capacity to invest in things that are going to create real momentum in the economy, but it's not meant to just blow up the property market and blow up the bank's balance sheets and create no real outcome at the end of the day.
But that is unfortunately what's happening. So we have asset bubbles. My father was a bank manager. I go back, you know, there's a funny story involving him giving a loan to our next door neighbour without our next door neighbour knowing that was the case because the next door neighbour banked a circular key and we were in Hurstville, but it happens that Mum told Dad what a good bloke the next door neighbour was, so Dad approved the loan. this sort of local knowledge is what used to happen in bank branches. Yep. And my favourite example, which still applies today in Germany, where there are so many small regional banks, I remember going to a concert in a volcanic caldera in just near Bonn about 12 years ago, and being introduced to an old couple on the park bench in this village of 5,000 people, and asking, what business do they run, expecting it to be making, sauerkraut and that stuff like that. Satellites. This town of 5,000 people had a factory making satellites. And the reason is because these two people were top-class engineers. The bank manager knew they were top-class engineers, gave them the money to establish the building. Bang, off you go. The factory exists. I imagine it's still going today. So that sort of local knowledge and where banks lend for businesses is what you want the private sector to be doing. Instead, these days, it's all centralised. Type in your numbers. What are your point scores? Which region do you live in? Bang, loan approved in 20 seconds. And it's all for about asset price inflation, and the banks wouldn't have a clue about a satellite business these days, which is what they should be actually helping to come into existence.
Well, I'll tell you something that I've learned today, because my father was also a bank manager.
Ah.
And he has, when he was running his local bank, he was alongside the vicar, right, and the doctor, right? It was that sort of relationship. He knew everybody in the local community, and he was a trusted advisor, but also somebody who helped the local organizations to develop in his local area, right? And he knew more about those businesses than anybody in head office.
Yeah, and, exactly.
It's like that's how banking should be done, and that's not what banking is today. Now go on.
Yeah, sorry. I've once got a taxi driver in Sydney who was an ex-bank manager, and he drove past a couple of the sites and said, "See that building there?" He said, that's one I approved. And he drove along and said, "Now these days, all they do is drive past like you and I and make sure there's a building on the block. Back in my day, I'd go inside and check and see whether there were any structural cracks in the building, etc., etc." It's all become a point scoring system, and it just inflates asset prices rather than providing money for the real economy.
Now, you mentioned a couple of times the concept of debt jubilee. And, if we assume that quantitative easing is not going to get us out of jail and we're just going to do more of the same, asset prices will go on getting inflated higher, the house price stupidity will continue unless the rate of change of credit growth, new credit growth, changes, right? Mm-hmm. And that's where the key to jubilee comes in, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And what I've been looking at is, and I've got a model, what I've suggested with a reasonable understanding of how banking operates a dozen years ago, I've got a much better understanding now, was that we should have a modern debt jubilee. So rather than just as an old-fashioned jubilee, wrote off all household debt. That was, if you go back to the ancient Sumerian times, right up to the early Roman times, when a jubilee was declared, it didn't write off corporate debt. Business debts, traders' debts still remained there, but household debts were abolished. And that would often mean people who had become slaves because they couldn't pay their debts, often to the tavern owners, by the way, then they would be freed to go back and work on their land when the jubilee was declared. But you couldn't do that now. You couldn't say we let the debtors off and don't do anything about anybody else, because we all work in this third party sense through banks, and that would be rewarding people who borrowed money to gamble and speculate, and not rewarding those who stood by the side, but they just didn't like the gambling and speculation. So a modern debt jubilee would get everybody the same amount of money, but then created by the Treasury, but then would require anybody who had debt to pay their debt down by the amount they received. But anybody who didn't have debt would get a cash injection. And the cash injection I would require to be used to buy newly issued corporate shares, where those corporate shares would have to be used to retire corporate debt. So the idea was you'd dramatically reduce private debt in the household sector, and you'd also reduce corporate debt, and you would also democratise to some fair degree the ownership of shares, because if you do it on a per capita basis, you'll be giving far more that money to workers than you are to capitalists, because there's far more workers than capitalists. Yeah, that would reverse the unfairness of what's happened with QE. And what, since I didn't model it back in 2011, 2012, when I first proposed it, because I didn't have the sort of software capacity to do that. But I've now invented that software. That's my Minsky software. And I have modeled how a modern Jubilee could proceed. And much to my amazement, even though part of it was not increasing the money supply, the impact was a dramatic stimulus to economic activity, largely because you change the balance of where money is from bankers to workers. Workers spend more rapidly than bankers do, and therefore GDP gets driven up without any change in the money supply.
Right. So the implication of that is that you basically, take the top off the debt, as it were, right? You reorientate the balance in the economy between the productive end of the economy, where people are going to spend, compared with the, you know, the rich people who don't spend, can't spend it because they've already spent as much as they can spend anyway.
Yeah.
And it fundamentally then tilts the playing field. The question, I guess, is, could you do that in a single country, or does it need to be something which is sort of coordinated across multiple geographies?
It could easily be done in a single country. And I think, I mean, what I've realised, certainly in terms of working in the global warming field as well, is that an international agreement is the best way to make sure something doesn't happen. So all these international agreements over carbon prices, therefore we've never had a carbon price of any significance brought in. But if you do it at the national level, then it can work straight away. So like a nation state, a nation that produces its own money. So this is not available to members of the European Union because they've got the euro. They don't have their own treasuries. But any country with its own currency can implement a modern debt jubilee overnight. And the impact, I think, would actually be to stimulate the economy quite substantially. And it could be a way of saying to people in other countries, we should give that a try.
Right. So therefore, it's about having a political will to do it, right? Inside an economy, inside a country with its own currency. And then basically prove that it works. And then others will say, oh, that's a good way to solve the problem.
Yeah, but it won't happen, of course, because, I mean, if you think about it, this is why I describe what we have these days as not what Eisenhower, General Eisenhower, of course, termed the military-industrial complex. That was in his final speech as president. He actually coined the term the military-industrial complex.
Yep.
I think what we have these days is the politico-financial complex.
Yep.
So the only people that politicians speak to on a regular basis are members of the finance sector. And their entire mental orientation is making sure the finance sector gets stronger when it's already far too strong. It should be reduced in scale. So with that attitude, they'd never consider anything like what I'm suggesting with a modern debt jubilee. And therefore, I think we'll never see it. But it's feasible. It could be done. I've done the mechanics, you know, again, in my Minsky software. I've modelled the mechanics of it. It would be quite straightforward to bring it about.
Right, and that's really the point, isn't it? And people need to understand this, that behind the quantitative easing programs and behind the current things that are going on, there's a set of ideological assumptions and a set of doctrinal positions that are driving. In other words, they're choices that are being made, and your point is there are alternative choices that could be made if you, you know, turned to look at it differently.
Yeah, and it's again, it somehow sounds strange to people. It sounds a bit mystical. But I really think the best analogy I can make about the state of economics now is it's like astronomy before Copernicus.
Yeah.
They have a model which says the Earth is the center of the universe and the stars and sun and moon rotate around us, and they're building intricate mathematical models that can fit the data, so you can actually fit previous history of planetary cycles, and you can predict where the planets are going to be in 300 years' time and be pretty close to correct. Everybody's got a slightly different model, so you can actually say, oh, you haven't seen so-and-so's model. So-and-so's model covers that issue. You know, whenever I criticise this bullshit they pump out. But with that attitude, you can have an accurate prediction using a model which is completely wrong. And the trouble is that then reinforcing, because when they do their predictions, my model got, I managed to modify my shocks my exogenous shocks are that I fitted the financial crisis. Aren't I great? No, you've got a load of bullshit there. You've just managed to tweak the numbers so it reproduces the data, but there's no way you actually understand the system itself. And with neoclassical economists running everything, we're stuck.
Now, on that point, do you see parallels between what you've just said and the broader issue of climate change and, you know, the global warming thing and the IPCC and all that sort of stuff? But it seems to me that we're following a rather similar cooking book, as it were.
Cooking book is a good way to put it, because we're the ones being cooked. Yes, it is. And I'm beyond appalled with the state of economic theory when it comes to climate change. And the reason is because the neoclassical economists begin with an orientation that says that capitalism is such a wonderful system, it can cope with anything, and therefore climate change can't be all that bad. I mean, that's the only way I can explain where they got to where they are, because if you look at climate change in a dispassionate way and say, you know, what would happen if we cause, for example, the what's called the AMOC, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. People would know the term the Gulf Stream, which is part of that system. What would happen if we shut it down? He said, you've got to be a lunatic to even talk about that. Oh, no, you've got to be a neoclassical economist. But that's what they do talk about. And they literally have decided that because on their models, the temperature would, the AMOC would reduce the temperature of Europe, because the AMOC brings warm water from the equatorial up to the coast of Europe and therefore makes Europe several degrees warmer than it would be otherwise. To take that out of the way, and we've got, well, that goes down and climate warming is going up. So overall, it's a good idea to shut AMOC down. Now, I would think anybody who said that would deserve to have their mouth washed out with Greenland's ice sheet, because that's what they're risking. But this is what they've actually bloody well said. And the most recent paper I'm looking at this front was published 3 or 4 days ago. And here we say, slowdown of the AMOC, this is the abbreviation for that, you know, overturning circulation, reduces the expected social cost of carbon by 1.4%. Which means, of course, it's making climate change less dangerous, so it'd be a good idea to lose AMOC. And this is economists. They haven't got a... you can use French on your show, can't I?
Go on.
They haven't got a fucking clue about the planetary dynamics they're playing with.
Yeah.
And they actually ended up... And this is a recent paper, as I said, 2 or 3 days ago. They then considered... one thing they've been criticised for, and I've done the criticism as well, is saying, you guys have ignored tipping points in the climate. So you've imagined we can have an increase in temperature without changing fundamental aspects of the climate, like, for example, Arctic sea ice, Greenland, et cetera, et cetera. And once you tip these, you get a dramatic increase, acceleration in the rate of change, which should turn up in a change in the slope of the change processes you're looking at. So, for example... one of the places we know as a tipping point is the Arctic. And the Arctic, when there's ice on the Arctic during summer, 90% of the solar radiation that hits the Arctic is reflected back into outer space. Okay. But if you have dark, if the ice is gone, 90% is absorbed. Now, that doesn't, most people say that's the Arctic, that can't matter all that much. Because the Arctic is in sunlight for all of summer, the amount of radiation it receives is equivalent to that received around the equatorial belts. So you suddenly go from, it's like going from having one equatorial belt to two. And that if you wanted to have an equivalent increase in the temperature of the planet through carbon dioxide, that is equivalent to, a 1,000 gigatons of carbon when we emit 25 gigatons per year. So it's like, if it happens in 5 years, the transition 5 to 10 years from complete coverage to no coverage, that is like 40 years of global warming in one go. Now, this paper concluded that if we had a 6 degree increase in global temperature, and that means goodbye West Antarctic, goodbye Greenland, Arctic is obviously gone, AMOC is gone, total chaos in terms of the El Nino, La Nina, and so on, a completely different climate, they consume, that would reduce GDP by 1.4%. And they fitted it using a fucking quadratic, which is exactly the nonsense they used when they weren't using tipping points. And I look at this thing, see, can you guys even just realize how absurd your arguments are? So tipping points reduce global consumption per capita by about 1% upon 3 degrees Celsius warming and by 1.4% upon 6 degrees warming based on a second order polynomial fit of the data. And that's why I say there's no point trying to persuade these people. We've got to eliminate them. Economists should have no official role whatsoever. Go and get them to take over churches somewhere. We need a church of economics. Pull them out of the universities. Pull them out of government departments. They can go and preach to each other somewhere. But for Christ's sake, pardon the pun, don't let them control policy, because this is the nonsense they come up with.
I remember speaking with Michael Hudson a couple of years ago, and he said, you know, the problem is that the particular ways of thinking that you're talking about are so inculcated into the academic sector, universities, and corporates and politics. You know, it's like if you don't think that way, then you're not in the system, as it were.
You're not part of the club. Yeah. I'm not part of the club.
Yeah. No, I understand that. And I understand precisely what Michael said, and I understand what you're saying there. But of course, it raises the really, really big question, because if in fact, the people trying to make some of those decisions are actually just using those models that are really inappropriate or ineffective, they're not going to actually necessarily, create the momentum that's required to really tackle the criticality of the issues that are clearly out there for people who want to see them. And yet, again, goes back to your comment earlier on. Well, you know, you can't get a global agreement on carbon, right? But we're on one planet, right? We've only got one planet's worth of resources, and we are consuming them at the rate of, 2.5 to 3 times at the moment, right? Which suggests to me that the questions we should be asking are things like, how do you get a no-growth economy to work, or maybe even a shrinking economy to work? I mean, there's a set of questions which don't seem to me to be being asked, but should be being asked.
Yeah, that's true. And like, what really pisses me off about these guys, and almost all guys, is that they, from their point of view, they're raising the alarm. They're saying how bad this can be, because like a 1.4% decline in consumption over what it would be without tipping points. So without tipping points, you get a certain level of damage to GDP of the order of 5% of GDP, less than it would be without global warming at all, and you include tipping points 1.4% more, that's really bad. That's a 25% increase in the damages. We should be out there doing something like a carbon tax, and we're trying to... No, mate, you're saying this is so fucking trivial you can ignore it. Okay, you're enabling the Bjorn Lombergs, and Bjorn Lomberg quotes these guys quite extensively. Okay, he's enabling the climate deniers, it's enabling the fossil fuel mobs to say it doesn't really matter. Now it does matter, and like just to give you, I know I'm not quite answering your question. I want to come back and just talk about how absurd this particular paper is, because they talk about what they call equilibrium sensitivity. They're comparing a planet where we have a zero increase over global the pre-industrial temperature to 6 degrees over the pre-industrial when everything else has settled down. Okay, now at 6 degrees everything goes. Okay, there is no West Antarctic ice sheet, there is no Greenland. Now that means, for a start, a 70 meter increase in sea levels. Okay, now 70 meters, I'm pretty certain your house would be underwater at 70 meters even with your view. Okay, it's the CBD of Sydney. That would be the CDD, the Central Diving District. and equally New York, London, Amsterdam. Well, Amsterdam would be 73 metres below sea level. There wouldn't be. 70% to 80% of where humans live would be underwater. And they're saying the impact on GDP compared to where that didn't happen would be 1.4% of GDP. Now, and they think they're raising the alarm. You know, it's just fucking absurd. You can tell how angry I am about all this stuff. But I've been thinking, well, obviously, with that sort of stupid, moronically bad advice, being provided by to governments, and governments don't read the fine print. They don't go and check and see how did this guy get that result. They must, he must have done it properly. Bullshit. He used crap methodology, which you know, should have you thrown out of any university, and I'm hoping to get economists expelled from universities, quite frankly. That's one of my long-term ambitions, to get them shut down completely, remove them from universities. They can go pay for it themselves if they want to teach this to other people. Get them out of there. Okay. But so we're not going to do this until after the crisis hits. And the biggest one that scares me is we're now seeing signs that AMOC actually is breaking down, the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation, which is what keeps Europe warm. Now, if that does go, then that doesn't change the temperature we're absorbing. It means that more of the temperature stays at the equatorial level and it's colder towards the north, which is the opposite of the trend overall from global warming. And what that means is an enormous increase in the energy difference between the tropics and the temperate zones. And the odds are, looking at a paper by Hansen, not Pauline, thank God, but by James Hansen from 2016, he said, this is the only explanation they have for superstorms they saw happening during the Miocene period, when boulders, you know, 1,000-ton boulders were thrown well into the coast of Ireland. And the idea, we're likely to get superstorms. So I think if it's actually happening now, then we're likely to see the consequences of something like that in the next decade, like a superstorm which throws, you know, 20 and 30 meter waves at the coast of Europe. And if that happens, and if then we react, well, then we're going to be in, how the hell do we reverse the damage we've done? So my proposal, I have a proposal to address, doing it after the event rather than before, which is carbon rationing. And the idea with carbon rationing would be to price everything, both in money and carbon, and to provide a universal carbon credit to everybody, preferably on a daily basis through a central bank, so that when you went shopping, whatever shopping you would do, commercial or corporate shopping, you would be paying both a monetary price and a carbon price. And you would exhaust your carbon ration very rapidly if you were rich. But if you were poor, you'd never even come anywhere near it. So the rich, if they wanted to continue consuming at the rate they are, would have to buy carbon credits off the poor. And that would mean the rationing would actually financially benefit 90 to 95% of the population. So that is something that would have political appeal and put enormous pressure on both, on the wealthy in particular, to reduce the level of carbon loading. And it would be also an income and wealth redistribution from the rich to the poor. So that's my proposal to get around it. And it could be done again at the national level. You wouldn't need international agreement to do this. You could do it like if this happens. Let's say Amsterdam gets wiped out by a superstorm, and the Dutch government decides, "Oh shit, we should have taken this more seriously," and then brings in carbon pricing on all commodities and universal carbon credits for people to go shopping. Then whatever is left of the Netherlands could have an economic revival in that situation. And the idea would be to say, well, the poor come through this better than they do with any other scheme, and therefore there'd be pressure, political pressure, to do this elsewhere in the world. So it's my proposal anyway, at least one way to try to redress both the damage we've done to the climate and the damage we've done to the distribution of income.
Very interesting. And of course, so many commonalities from the earlier conversation that we had. And, you know, it's the same old, isn't it?
Yeah.
But you didn't answer directly my question, which was, you know, is the concept of perpetual growth actually one we've got to actually wean ourselves off?
We have to. Yeah. Well, I think the idea we can have perpetual growth, it was always wrong. If you didn't believe in perpetual growth, the term of abuse for you in neoclassical economic circles, well, you're a Malthusian. Well, yes, I'm a Malthusian. There are physical limits to the planet, and by being encouraged to believe there aren't physical limits, we've tripled the load we put on the planet from where we were back in the 1970s, and therefore we've gone well past the point where we can have market mechanisms that cope with it, let alone well past the points where we can continue growing. So we have to shrink the economy dramatically to take the load off the planet. And the burden of that has to fall on the rich, not the poor. If it falls on the poor, that'll be the end of human society. We'll fall apart in warring factions, which unfortunately I think is what's going to happen.
And thinking about, you know, numbers and populations and things, some people would say, well, there's a convenient COVID thing happening, you know. Is that going to be part of the get-out-of-jail card?
Well, this is one of the many impacts of putting too much pressure on the environment. Pathogens just want a host, and if you have all the other hosts are shrinking and one is growing, then evolutionary pressure is going to mean the pathogens turn up for the growing population, not for the declining ones. So COVID, I see, as a first blast of climate change coming back and hitting our excessive numbers on this planet. And I don't think there's any conscious thought in that sense by policymakers about, oh, this is going to make things easier. Mm-hmm. They're still wedded to the idea of, you know, growth at all costs. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, we're not going to make the decision consciously. We're going to have it, the biosphere is going to end up coming back at us, and that'll determine how many humans can exist. And when you look at people like Will Steffen and his estimates, saying that if we have a globe which is 4 degrees warmer than now, the carrying capacity for humans is probably about 1 billion. Well, there's 7.5 billion of us.
Hmm. Yeah, and the reason that behind my question was, James Lovelock some time ago, right, argued that, you know, Gaia, even with the whole system, what was essentially a complete system in its own right, and it would actually start self-correcting and changing and morphing in reaction to whatever threats or balances that there are there. And, you know, I've had the view for some time that, in a way, the COVID thing is a manifestation of you know, Gaia reacting.
Yeah, quite probably. I mean, people don't realise Lovelock was actually quite a sophisticated mathematical modeller, and his Gaia model was actually of he called it daisy world, and you had two types of daisies, evolution could favour one or the other, dark daisies and light daisies, and then as the sun's intensity rose, which is part of what he was modelling, because it is rising over time, you had a decline in the dark daisies and a rise in the white ray daisies, so the temperature change on the planet was far less than the temperature change, the energy change coming from the sun. So in that sense, we have been pushing this envelope as a species dramatically, because we're putting into the atmosphere accumulated energy, solar energy stores from millions of years ago. We're dumping millions of years of carbon in hundreds of years or tens of years, and therefore drastically changing the temperature balance of the planet. And we've used that to become by far the dominant species. So the mass of humans on the planet, plus the animals humans breed to eat and otherwise exploit, far exceeds the mass of all other mammals on the planet. And so we're just become a plague in that sense for the planet. And the planet's, because life is such a strong force on this planet, the other elements of that life system, the ones that can react to us, are saying, oh, here we go. This is a great resource to exploit. So, bang, we're getting COVID. We probably get 2 or 3 major pathogens in addition to that coming out in the future. And the more our social systems break down, the more likely we are to have those pathogens develop.
Yeah, and so sort of coming right back down to the individual, right? And one of the things that I'm seeing quite a lot in my conversations and social feeds are people feeling rather helpless, right? They can see all these things happening, you know, they can see quantitative easing going off over there, and they can see the COVID thing going off over there, and they got climate change, right? I guess the question I've got is, you know, for you who've been, you know, in this stream of consciousness for a long, long time and trying to sort of figure out, what can people do in terms of, you know, responding to some of these things and trying to make a difference?
Well, I mean, there's very little individuals can do. One reason I moved to Thailand was COVID, but another one was that I thought when the crisis hits, this is part of the world that's got the very short food chain, so the odds are food will be easier to find when things start to fall apart, because most people can't do anything like what I've done here. But to a large degree, because it's driven by an ideology, a false ideology, which has become part of both mainstream political parties throughout the world, Labour and Conservatives in the UK, Republicans and Democrats in America, Liberal and Labour here, all ascribe to a neoliberal vision of the world, which is a false vision. And there's enough the minority of people who are thinking that these days, and the venality of people who do it, because they said it's all about self-interest. They don't see anything wrong with, sports rorts. Let's use money to buy the next election. Let's whack, four train stations in the Treasurer's electorate, one of which is not near a train station and won't ever have a train station next to it. But here's the money, to my local people to help us. And you might well decide to vote for me because I paid you money to vote for me. And there's nothing wrong with that. We all know this happens. It's so fucking corrupt that, and it's an institutional form of corruption. It's not paper bags, under the table between members of the mafia and the local constabulary. It's out and in your face use of the power of being in control to keep your faction in control. And that has disgusted so many people that you've got things like the New Liberals being formed in Australia. And I took a bit of due diligence on the people behind the New Liberals, particularly Victor Klein, who was the original source of it. And I thought, okay, these are people who have ethics. And yes, I'm going to support them. So that's my own collective action, and that's what I'd recommend other people to do. Join a group like the New Liberals, whose first principles are ethics and not falling for neoliberalism, and start breaking the politics away. But beyond that, I do unfortunately think that humans never... We're not Vulcans, if you know your Star Trek. Okay, we don't make a rational calculation and decide that's a silly way to go. Let's go some other way. We're much more, what's his name, Captain Kirk. We crash in and then have to pick up the pieces afterwards. So I think it's partly, I'm not just going to blame neoclassical economists for this. Humanity has never, when it's faced with an existential threat before, stopped doing what caused the existential threat. We've continued doing it because it supports the current power structure. And then when it undermines the sustainability of the power structure, then we have a revolution and an overthrow, and we're back into another system again. But this time we've done it with the entire planet. And I think in that situation, I think we're going to have a huge, a very, very drastic impact on the survivability of the planet for humans. It will be crazy, like some of the floods we've seen in Germany recently, the fires in America. That sort of stuff is going to become the stuff of daily news and daily experience. And then after a bit of that, people think, holy shit, this is serious. I've got to do something about it. What can we do? And the answer is, you've got to think incredibly drastic, because 85% of our energy comes from fossil fuels. And we're using far too much anyway. So you've got to have a drastic decline, and you've got to accept it in the same sense you accept controls on your behaviour and controls on your consumption when you're fighting a war. Mm. And until we change that mindset, I don't think we've got a hope of reversing the direction we're going in right now.
Well, Steve, I appreciate your time today. I'm always very thoughtful and so well argued. And, I think the point really to close on is, there are a lot of big challenges. There are glimpses of a little bit of hope. But frankly, the ride ahead is going to be a bit wild and probably rather disruptive.
Very, very disruptive. And, what can we hang on to if humanity... when the structure that we built to support humanity starts collapsing around us because it's too damn big for the planet.
Yep. Profound question to leave us with. Steve, thank you very much for your time today. And I hope we can catch up again down the track and see how things are panning out.
What a pan. Okay, we'll do that, mate. Bye-bye.
Thank you. See ya.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye.